This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your cachava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of cachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS.
Welcome to a deep dive into your stack of sources.
Yeah.
We're looking at some really critical shifts in global trade, power dynamics in D.C., and, well, how fast institutional America seems to be complying.
That's right. Our sources give us this incredible vantage point, don't they?
They really do.
And our mission today really is to help you understand the current playbook. We're going to look at where the executive branch is pushing boundaries, where institutional checks are maybe holding or not.
Yeah.
And crucially, why certain powerful players, you know, tech billionaires, foreign powers, seem to be making deals out of, well, maybe expediency.
Or maybe fear.
Could be fear. We'll cover a lot. New tariffs, canceled solar farms,
yeah.
The works.
Okay, let's get into it. We have sources on some intense trade negotiations, a government shutdown that's not playing by the usual rules, big court fights.
Yeah.
And of course, the market data that kind of reflects all this chaos. The connective tissue, it seems, is how transactional fear is driving huge decisions both here and, you know, globally. Let's kick off with the U.S.-China trade stuff.
Yeah.
Because the negotiation style in the sources, it's something else.
It really is. It starts with that analogy, right? The piano vendor.
I can explain that.
Okay. So the idea is you order expensive pianos, they get delivered, you claim they're crappy, and then you just offer like 50 cents on the dollar.
Banking on the vendor being too small to sue.
Exactly. And the source suggests the thinking was, well, this tactic should work against China too.
Against the world's second largest economy. Wow.
Well, what's fascinating is President Xi didn't really play the victim. Instead of, you know, begging for tariffs to be lifted, he hit back hard.
How?
Export controls on rare earth elements. And these aren't just, you know, random materials. They're absolutely vital for making EV batteries, specialized magnets, semiconductors.
Stuff we really need.
Crucial stuff. It's a very sophisticated countermove, actually.
And the U.S. response just escalated again.
Pretty much a direct threat. 100% tariffs on all Chinese exports. Everything.
On top of the existing ones.
On top of existing ones. Plus, threatening to cancel a key meeting with Xi.
Okay, but that puts the administration in a really tight spot, doesn't it?
A massive bind. Because if Xi actually calls that bluff and those tariffs go on.
Inflation goes through the roof.
Absolutely soaring inflation right before the midterms next year. That's a huge political risk. House and Senate races.
So the bluff probably has to be withdrawn.
That's the analysis. The prediction is Taco Trump accepts concession offer. Basically, they'll back down but need a small face-saving win.
And the prediction is soybeans. Seriously.
Yeah, like importing an extra million tons of soybeans or something similar.
Why soybeans?
Because it lets the administration say, see, yep. We forced China to buy more American stuff. It fits the strong negotiator narrative.
So they can claim a victory.
they can crow about a win, exactly, while actually giving up nothing on the core issues. Rare earths, structural trade problems, those remain. Exactly. All about the optics.
The sources also mentioned a scarier path, right? Like if things really escalated?
Oh, yeah. Terrifying alternatives, like the U.S. banning Boeing's spare parts exports.
Oof.
And then China maybe retaliating with controls on, say, vital chemicals or even key ingredients for medicines we import.
It's like holding the global economy hostage.
It really is. And it seems when the stakes get that high, suddenly anything can be on the table. Which maybe brings us to that other really shocking deal in the sources.
The quid pro quo.
Feels like it. This sudden kind of out-of-the-blue deal involving military bases.
You mean letting Qatar build a facility inside an existing U.S. Air Force base? Mountain homes in Idaho?
Exactly. This is, well, it's unprecedented. Foreign countries train here, sure. But they stay separate or alongside U.S. troops.
They don't build their own base on our base.
Never. Especially not inside a secure installation like that.
Why is that such a red line?
Huge security risks. I mean, think about it. Potential for surveillance, spying, maybe even theft of sensitive tech or info.
Right. That's why the rules exist.
Precisely. So for this to happen, as one article points out, Qatar must have offered something incredibly valuable in return. A massive trade concession, maybe? A diplomatic favor? Something big enough to justify this security compromise.
And the political reaction was fierce, right? Even from allies.
Immediate and intense. You saw key allies just like lose it. Calling it a betrayal, compromising sacred soil, it really fuels that perception of a major, potentially problematic transaction.
This sort of high-stakes, scorched-earth approach isn't just for foreign policy, is it? We're seeing it domestically with the government shutdown.
Absolutely. And the sources are really clear. This is not your standard shutdown kabuki theater.
Right. Usually it's furloughs. People get back pay eventually. Congress makes a deal.
Not this time. The strategy now seems geared towards, well, permanent damage. Driven by figures like Russell Vought.
And his goal isn't just gridlock.
His playbook, according to these sources, is much bigger. It's to break the federal government so badly firing specialists, dismantling offices, that even if Democrats win later, they couldn't fully repair it. Maybe not even in 4 years.
And they're doing it with permanent firings, not furloughs.
Permanent firings. Over 4,000 federal workers already gone. EPA, Treasury, HHS, Homeland Security.
Wow. Specific numbers.
Over 1,100 at HHS, 1,400 at Treasury, including dozens at the CDC. They even closed the CDC's DC office.
And they're just ignoring the law about 30 days notice.
Seems like it. Mm. Which has led to immediate lawsuits, of course. The tactic appears to bank on Democrats caving fast because, you know, thousands hurt right before the holidays. It forces their hand on policy demands.
But wait, doesn't firing highly specialized people, like at the CDC, hurt the administration too? I mean, don't they need government to function eventually?
That's the inherent tension, isn't it? For the people pushing this, the short-term goal dismantling what they see as the administrative state seems to outweigh those long-term governance risks.
They see the structure itself as the enemy.
Essentially, yes. Worth dismantling, even if it causes chaos in the meantime.
Okay, so that brings us to the Democrats' counter. They're not just fighting over funding levels, are they?
No, not at all. They're pushing back with some really complex structural demands to end this shutdown. This is where the real power struggle is happening.
Guardrails, they're calling them.
Exactly. Guardrails that go way beyond just, say, restoring health insurance subsidies. There are three key demands here, and they're constitutionally pretty significant.
Aimed at restoring Congress's power of the purse.
That's the core idea. Getting back the control over spending that the founders intended for Congress.
Okay, let's break them down. First one, making rescission bills non-privileged. What's a rescission bill and why does non-privileged matter?
Good question. A rescission bill is basically a tool the president can use to try and cancel spending. Congress has already approved. If it's privileged, it gets fast-tracked. Congress can't easily block it with a filibuster.
So the president can force cuts through.
Right. Making them non-privileged means Democrats could filibuster, giving them a way to stop the executive from just undoing spending deals after they're made.
Got it. Okay. And the other two demands target something called impoundment. What's that?
Impoundment is basically when the executive branch, the president, or OMB, whoever, simply refuses to spend money that Congress has legally appropriated.
Sit on the money.
Exactly. They keep it in the Treasury. It's like a pocket veto for spending, completely undermining Congress's authority.
So demand number two.
Grants organizations or agencies that lost funding because of illegal impoundment the right to actually sue in federal court to get that money back, overturning an old Supreme Court decision.
Giving them teeth. And the third one?
This one targets the officials directly. It would make federal officials who carry out impoundments, who refuse to send out the checks Congress approved, personally subject to fines.
So someone like Russell Vought could face personal penalties.
That seems to be the idea. Create real personal legal risk for officials who defy Congress on spending.
So basically, Democrats are trying to build actual enforcement mechanisms using courts and fines to force the executive to respect the separation of powers.
Precisely. And Republicans, seeing this as a major power grab backed by Congress, want no part of it, which explains why this shutdown is so incredibly intense. We're also seeing the executive testing limits elsewhere, like with domestic force deployment.
You mean trying to send the National Guard into Chicago?
That's the one. The attempt to deploy 500 Guard troops from Illinois and Texas into Chicago, ostensibly to fight crime.
But the courts pushed back fast.
Incredibly fast. Illinois Governor Pritzker sued straight away, and the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court, they ruled almost immediately. Very unusual.
How did they rule?
A one-page unsigned order. Super concise. It basically said the Guard could stay federalized, stay in the Chicago area, you know, armories, training sites.
But not deploy into the city.
Exactly. Strictly prohibited deployment for operational activities, arrests, patrols, that sort of thing. The court explicitly said it feared deployment would just lead to civil unrest, make things worse, not better.
So, what now? Supreme Court.
Looks like it. Illinois will almost certainly argue the Posse Comitatus Act.
That's the old 1878 law.
Right. Prohibiting using the military for domestic law enforcement. This case could set a really important precedent on presidential power over state forces.
Okay. Shifting gears to another institution under pressure. Universities.
Oh, yeah. They're facing their own squeeze. A classic carrot and stick play.
The stick being threats, canceling contracts.
Stuff like that. And the carrot, it's this vague, like, 10-page deal offering special benefits down the line if they comply.
But the compliance list is pretty intense, isn't it?
Extremely specific and severe. Universities have to agree to freeze tuition for 5 years.
Wow.
Limit foreign student numbers, define sex as only male or female, ban race and sex in admissions entirely, and get this, punish departments that belittle conservative ideas.
Punish departments? How would that even work?
It's not clear, which is part of the problem. But the institutional reaction told the story. MIT just flat out rejected it, called it a non-starter.
And that former Yabop president?
Yes. He called it a one-sided deal, pointed out that the promised benefits were only available where feasible.
Which is code for?
Code for probably never going to happen. While the requirements, the demands on the university were absolute and immediate, it highlights the transactional nature of the offer.
Okay, let's talk about Silicon Valley, because this is a big shift noted in the sources. Why are these tech billionaires, you know, traditionally maybe left-leaning or libertarian folks like Altman, Bezos, Cook, Nadella, Zuckerberg, why are they suddenly cozying up to this administration?
It seems like a mix of things, really, a convergence of factors.
Like what?
Well, first, there's just pure expediency and fear. These guys see an executor who can be, let's say, vengeful.
Right.
So maybe it's better to kind of butter him up, get access, stay on his good side, rather than become a target for retaliation or, you know, regulatory crackdown.
Self-preservation. Yeah. Makes sense. What else?
Second, anti-restraint. There seems to be real anger over even the mild regulations proposed by previous administrations. Any government interference is seen as just friction, slowing things down.
Okay, so fear and hating regulation, what about ideology?
That's the third piece. A strong aversion in some corners to DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, and identity politics generally.
They prefer just focusing on merit.
Solely on merit, as they define it.
Yeah.
And for some, that single issue seems to override almost any other political difference.
Interesting. Anything else?
Yeah, two more things. Crypto. Democrats generally are pretty skeptical. They see it as risky, maybe even a scam.
But the administration
loves it, promotes it, talks it up as this exciting new thing. That definitely appeals to the tech genius crowd who see digital assets as the future.
Okay, and the last one, technocracy.
Right. This is maybe the most fundamental. One source mentions figures like Peter Thiel, who apparently see democracy itself as kind of outmoded software. Yeah, like it needs replacing.
Right.
And they might see the current leadership as the ideal vehicle for dismantling those slow, messy democratic processes in favor of a more efficient technocracy.
Yeah.
Run by, well, people like them.
Wow. That's compared to you.
It is. And the great irony, as the sources point out, is this creates a really suboptimal situation locally.
Not so.
The bosses, the billionaires, are leaning right, often for these transactional reasons.
Hmm.
But the actual workers, the engineers and coders in places like Santa Clara and San Mateo counties,
they're overwhelmingly progressive.
Hugely. Kamala Harris won there by like 40 to 51 points in 2024. So you have this massive disconnect between the leadership making deals and the workforce. Really highlights the expediency factor.
And this expediency, this willingness to deal, it feeds directly into policy outcomes, right? Like killing projects favored by the other side.
Absolutely. Look at the Esmeralda 7 Cinder project in Nevada. Shocking cancellation.
That was going to be huge, wasn't it?
Largest solar plant in North America. 6.2 gigawatts. Enough to power like 2 million homes. Just gone.
And I know they kill it.
This is the policy irony. They used the extensive environmental review process, the very process Democrats championed for years to protect the environment.
They used the tool against the goal.
Exactly. The Interior Secretary, Doug Burgum, just canceled the review. His stated reason, solar power is just intermittent.
But the analysis suggests there was more to it.
Oh, yeah. Likely multiple drivers. Opposition to anything linked to Obama or Biden policies. Fulfilling promises made to oil and gas donors, perhaps.
And maybe even religion.
Possibly. A perceived conflict for some supporters between, you know, climate science and creationist beliefs. Embracing solar means accepting the science, which might challenge other beliefs.
So the path of least resistance is just cancel it.
Cancel it. And the expectation is Burgum will cancel more solar and wind projects. There's that executive order pausing renewables on federal land. And this seems to be the follow through. Hashtag tag outro. So before we finish, just a quick look at the market backdrop this week, because it really reflects this uncertainty.
Okay, what stood out?
Well, the U.S. dollar index got much stronger, about 1.2%, flipped to what analysts call a bullish trend. Meanwhile, Treasury yields went firmly bearish, which fits with some softer labor data coming in.
But the key thing.
I think, was the VIX, the volatility index. It spiked up over 22.
Yeah.
It moved into what they call the chop bucket. Basically, it signals that fear and just raw sentiment, not really economic fundamentals, are driving the market now.
Kind of mirroring the political and constitutional uncertainty we've been talking about.
Exactly. And look where money fled. Safe havens absolutely ripped higher. Precious metals, spot silver went over $50 an ounce, gold over $4,000, palladium surged 12%.
Money looking for safety.
Big time. While U.S. WTI oil actually sank below $59 a barrel, maybe signaling some worries about global growth amidst all this.
So tying it all together,
yeah.
We've seen this consistent pattern today, haven't we? Power being consolidated, projects getting killed, often through executive action, bypassing norms.
Whether it's global trade, the structure of government itself, or domestic energy policy, it feels like a rapid restructuring, driven by high stakes, by political goals, and maybe fundamentally by fear.
Yeah.
Which leaves us with a pretty important question, I think, for you to consider. When those checks and balances that were designed to limit the executive, like Congress controlling the money, when they're explicitly targeted, when they're threatened.
And lawmakers maybe back down out of fear of retaliation.
Right. What's the real cost of that institutional silence? How long can those norms, those guardrails, actually hold up under that kind of pressure, the pressure of fear, of expediency, before they just erode completely?
Something to definitely mull over.
Until our next deep dive.
Thank you for letting us guide you through your sources today.